From Iowa Public Radio, I'm Janine Beck, and this is The Exchange. Last week, the Iowa House approved a budget-cutting bill, which, among other things, would cut funding for sabbaticals at the state's public universities. Supporters say time off for research is critical for university professors, but critics say too much of the research is frivolous and wastes valuable taxpayer money. Another item on the chopping block is expanded passenger rail service in Iowa. Republican lawmakers argue the costs outweigh the benefits, but economic development officials argue additional rail lines would create jobs and increase transportation choices. We'll take a closer look at both sabbaticals and passenger rail coming up next on The Exchange. But first, the news. Good afternoon. I'm Janine Beck, and this is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. The Iowa House last week approved House File 45, known to majority Republicans as the Taxpayers First Act. It cuts $500 million in state spending over the next 3 years. Most of the attention has been focused on the elimination of the universal preschool for four-year-olds and smoking cessation programs. But Iowa's three public universities are concerned about language that prohibits or rather freezes state funding on sabbaticals for 18 months. Joining me on the first half of our program today, Republican Representative Nick Wagner of Marion. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
He's here with me in the Law Library of the State Capitol Building and in our studios in Iowa City, Professor Tom Cassavant, Director of the Center for Bioinformatics and Computational Biology at the University of Iowa. Professor Cassavant, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, freezing sabbaticals is estimated to save about $164,000 in 2012, which is not a particularly large amount in the scheme of the state budget. Let me ask you, Representative Wagner, is this largely symbolic? Is this a, you know, an issue that you just think they're not worthwhile?
I don't think it's a question of whether they're not worthwhile or whether they are, and I don't know that it gets down to the merits. I think there are definitely some of them that are very worthwhile and bring a lot of money back to the university in the form of grants and those types of things. But when you look at the list, excuse me, of someone that you see, you know, taking time off to complete a book or taking time off to complete their PhD, they're hard to explain to the taxpayer why we're paying someone to go get their PhD when a lot of the taxpayers here in Iowa either have paid for their own education or are struggling to pay for their education.
So why the freeze as opposed to an elimination?
Well, I think that gives us time to look at the whole situation and, you know, let the university perhaps change the way they're doing things, change the way they're approved, and, you know, instead of just going in and saying we're never going to do it again.
And I should say the state of Iowa is not the only state considering this kind of move. Many schools or states across the country, Truman State University in Missouri abolished sabbaticals for the budget year that began July 1st. In Louisiana, the governor, Bobby Jindal, there has asked that maybe universities consider sabbaticals as part of a budget cut. Wisconsin incoming Republican leaders are looking at sabbaticals. This is a move across the country as states look at tight budgets. Let me ask you, Professor Cassavant, are they worthwhile?
Yes, I think so. First, I want to thank Representative Wagner for kind of providing this opportunity to explore the issue, because I think it is a bit of a difficult one to understand. I actually grew up in Sioux City. I've lived in Iowa almost my whole life. And I really appreciate the stewardship of Republican senators who are representatives who are interested in, you know, very carefully managing our state resources. But I think the worthwhile question of this is pretty easy to answer. In fact, eliminating or freezing sabbaticals, depending on how it's done, could actually cost the university, you know, $4.5 million, based on last year's numbers.
That's the University of Iowa in particular,
right? Mm-hmm. So the proposal for that went to the regents outlined the cost of replacing the instruction, and the benefits last year were about $5 million in external grants. And I guess I can speak to the value of that, because, you know, my laboratory pays the salaries of about 20 to 30 people every year who are, you know, scientific staff, graduate students, and secretarial staff, a budget of about $1 million a year. And those are jobs, and that's money that goes into the economy. And I think that in terms of thinking about using resources effectively, I would really hate to see, you know, that lost opportunity, because I think that, you know, the entire budget of the University of Iowa brings a lot of benefits. And as you start to look at those benefits and where they come from, I think the sabbatical program or the Professional Development Award program over the years has shown to produce a lot more than it costs.
Well, let's back up a little bit, Professor Cassavant, and talk about what you talked about it, a professional development opportunity, or I know that sometimes they call it career development opportunities, layman's term sabbaticals. What are they and what's the typical use?
Well, so that's a good question, and I think, you know, it's very difficult to say the typical use because, in fact, it's a pretty broad spectrum. I can speak to my experience, and that is that, first of all, they're a competitive award. Not all of the requests for these are granted either at the department, the college, or at the provost level. Second, the typical award for me has involved going and working with a group, you know, that's away from the University of Iowa and that has a different perspective on a problem or takes some research that I've already done and cast it into a new area. And as one example of that, my research 20 years ago was strictly in the area of high-performance computing in electrical engineering. And I spent a year in Switzerland working with a group that, among other things, worked in structural computational biology, an area that I had absolutely no exposure to previously. In the 15 years since that point, this area has turned out to be an entirely new area of research that involves five different colleges here at the university and now has resulted in a training program for, you know, PhD students, master's students, and undergraduates in a number of departments in what is a really growing, very large growing area of the economy. So I think of, you know, my own experience and the things that I wouldn't have done in my career without that, and it's just hard to imagine.
Your research has brought back revenue then for the university, and you talked about your lab, but is that typical of sabbaticals? I mean, do they often result in grants, or are there sometimes more of a personal benefit in the sense of some time away to learn a new skill or to, you know, do some independent research, write a book, as Representative Wagner suggested?
Yeah, and as I said, I think there's a very broad spectrum of the kinds of payoffs, and I think some of them it's very easy to draw a very solid dark line from, you know, from the sabbatical to some tangible thing in the budget. I think, though, that the benefit of sabbaticals goes very far beyond that, and I think that our students, if I think of, you know, my own kids who have gone to college, and, you know, when I send them off and think of them encountering a faculty, I want them to encounter a faculty that doesn't just live in this enclosed ivory tower, but actually interacts with the rest of the world. And I think that's true whether that's in engineering or in science or in literature or the arts. I think that's what we expect of our faculty. And if they don't have opportunities to, you know, go and interact with people outside of their normal sphere of faculty in their department, that just won't happen.
Number of sabbaticals has been declining over the last couple of years. If you take a look at 2009, 167 were approved at the three universities by the Board of Regents, down to 95 in 2012. He also talked about it being an award based on merit. In 2011, 58% of the sabbaticals requested by professors were granted. Now, in 2012, as universities expected finances to improve a bit, that number went up to 77% of the sabbaticals requested were granted. Now, whether that's a numbers game because they felt like revenue was improving or they felt like the requests were better, I don't know. Those are just the numbers we have. Representative Wagner, what about his concerns that professors get out of that ivory tower, so to speak, on occasion and see other things so that they're providing a broader information to their students?
Sure. Excuse me again. I think those are important things to do. When you look at, you know, my degree is in engineering. I've spent my entire professional career in engineering. When we need to do professional development, our company puts money into it and gets us to do the professional development that we need. And I don't think that we should expect anything different from our universities. And so from that aspect, you know, we've got to look at these and make sure that they are going to provide a return to both our students and to our faculty. And so, again, I don't know that it's, you know, the merits of whether they are important or not, I think, can certainly be shown. It's a matter of we've got to look at this, and what we've seen in the past as far as those that have been approved it's very difficult to explain to the taxpayer how that one makes sense and how some of those make sense. So I think
Can you give us examples? I mean, I think that's what people struggle with, because obviously Mr. Cassavant's work, you know, is easy to understand that, that might leverage money, that it might also, you know, raise the profile of the university and gene research and things like that. But are there somewhere you've just said, you know, and is it unfair to those professors? Because I can imagine they're in history or literature in which people say, now, how does that benefit? But maybe to their coursework, someone might say it does.
Sure. And the ones that, I mean, one in particular, like I mentioned, was the entire description is taking a semester off to finish up her PhD. Now, I'm under the impression, and so are taxpayers, that when you get a sabbatical to take off to go get your PhD,
maybe that should be unpaid time.
Maybe, you know, if that's a personal development, if in my company, I went to my boss and said, hey, I need to go out and get my PhD, they're going to say, well, fantastic, go enjoy yourself. You know, and we may work out some sort of deal to where I can work part time, or I'll continue the job I'm in to provide some input back to that employer. But at the same time, some of that's got to be on my own shoulders. So, I mean, those are types of things that are difficult. And, you know, again, I think there's meritorious sabbaticals out there. But when we see some of these come through that are like that are very hard to explain, someone, you know, how do you distinguish between what should be approved and what shouldn't be approved? Without getting into the exact details of sending every single one to the legislature, we've just kind of said, hey, let's step back and take a look at these and put the pressure on the regent universities to maybe have a little more discerning eye as they're looking at some of these items.
Right.
We want to invite our listeners to join this conversation as well. If you have a question, have you taken a sabbatical and felt like it was worthwhile? Did you have a professor who was on leave that you felt was worthwhile, or that it was a time away that wasn't worthwhile, that they got paid for a holiday, in your opinion? Give us a call at 1-866-780-9100. Again, join our conversation at 1-866-780-9100. You can email us at the exchange at iowapublicradio.org, or of course find us on Twitter at IPR Talk.
So I just wanted to say that I don't know the details of this, of the case that Representative Wagner's mentioned here, but I would agree with him. I actually am surprised that a sabbatical was approved for someone to finish their PhD. In fact, it's a requirement for being a professor. So I guess I'm a little puzzled by that one as well. And I would hope that there would be a mechanism to call sabbatical requests, and I would think that would be the region's job. So I think I'm just sitting here being very puzzled about that one.
And if it is the region's job, do you feel like you're micromanaging Representative Wagner, or is this sort of pressure, just applying pressure? Is that what this is about?
Well, again, I think it's difficult. I mean, you could call it micromanaging if you want, and in many respects, maybe it is, because again, as you've looked at and you've given someone the responsibility of being the manager of that particular, you know, whether it's these approvals or something else, if they're not doing the job that you think they are doing or should be doing, then you need to step in at some point at some level. Now, again, I think at this point we've just said, hey, we've seen kind of some of these that don't make any sense, and we would hope that, that they wouldn't be passing through, but they are. So at this point, then you got to step in and do something. And I think that's what we've said at this point we need to do.
The president of the state's largest public employees union, Ask Me, is Danny Homan, and he has been quoted in articles as saying that he thinks sabbaticals are paid vacation, and at a time that state workers are taking furloughs and being laid off in some cases, that he just thinks they're unfair. Professor Cassavant, university employees are public employees who also in many cases did take furloughs during the last budget cuts, but do you understand his concerns?
I do, and I think that if it were actually the case that I requested a sabbatical and then went on vacation for 6 months, I would be in complete agreement with the union leader. On the other hand, when I was in Stockholm for my last sabbatical, I went to work every day. I had a lab where I was interacting with people, where I was doing my own research. And in fact, because of the time difference between there and here and my students, my graduate students and, other meetings that I had to attend on, over the Internet, I quite often was working 10, 12-hour days. So, in fact, the name sabbatical, you know, not only is it avoided for kind of, you know, the connotation of it being, you know, a rest, it just isn't. In fact, it was a time where I was actually engaged, but in many ways more focused in a way that is very difficult to do when I'm on campus and attending to, you know, so many administrative duties and interacting with quite so many students in undergraduate courses.
When universities have talked about curtailing sabbaticals, there's often been an outcry from professors who feel like, and when I say the term, not that it's a rest period, but that there's also a benefit to being away from the class period for burnout. Is that true? I mean, is there a feeling that if you step away from a time that you might be a better teacher or?
It depends. I personally don't get burned out on teaching. I love interacting with students. And in fact, it's one of the things that I rather miss while I'm off for a semester. I do teach every semester. And this semester, I have about 140 undergraduates in a freshman course. I really enjoy that. But there's no doubt that that takes a big chunk of my time to administer a course like that and all of the other staff that's associated with a course like that. Stepping away from that is actually a sacrifice, and there are personal sacrifices associated with going away. I mean, I have a house and a family, and at times when we took a sabbatical in the past, you know, our kids went to school and had to learn another language and be away from their friends. So I think it's very easy to have the impression that it is just a quote time off. In fact, it's a reloading and a recharging kind of operation, for this kind of sabbatical that I've been involved in. And I know of colleagues who have had similar experiences.
Is this at all an occasion where one that might seem frivolous to one person may not to another, but can give the whole process a bad name? I mean, if somebody is taking time off to write a book, while that may be worthwhile to their profession, someone else is saying, well, but they're going to maybe make a profit off of that book. And so, I mean, do you ever have internal arguments as professors about which ones are legitimate in your minds?
Not arguments, but I guess I would just say as you were mentioning that, I think this is true of every profession. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, the political sphere is certainly the case that some politicians, I think that, you know, you look at what they're doing and you say this, they're wonderful public servants, and others, they're wasting their time on issues that don't matter or just trying to, help themselves out. So I think it could be said in virtually any profession.
What do you guys, Professor Castevant, before I let you go, what's the plan now? Will there be a fight? Will there be an attempt to speak with legislators, a write-in campaign, anything? Or will you guys largely go unheard?
Yeah, I was delighted to have this opportunity to do this. Do I intend to fight? Absolutely not. I think the benefit of doing this is so obvious to me that, you know, giving up, all the things that could come from freezing for a year just seems to me like it's not a good use of the resources. I mean, we invest enormously in our public institutions. And to basically say that because there's a few of these that are questionable, that we're gonna turn down, you know, the millions of dollars and the great enriching opportunities for faculty for an entire year. To me, I think that as a taxpayer and as somebody who's lived in this state a long time, I would rather, you know, see the debate play out and do something that's a little more strategic than that.
All right. Let me ask you, Representative Wagner, where do you see this legislation going? It now goes to the democratically controlled Senate. Have you spoken with any of your colleagues in the Senate and those in the majority of what areas of this bill will pass and what won't? And is this one of those, the freeze on sabbaticals, that you suspect will remain in?
I would suspect that it would remain in. You know, coming out of the House, it was a 100-0 vote. I mean, it was a unanimous vote to have the sabbaticals in there. So, I guess it is the Senate's prerogative to do what they feel they should do with it. But I would guess that it does stay in there. And I think, again, I don't know, it's a discussion on the merits of whether or not that they, bring money in and help out our faculty and staff. And so I would hope that the university could look at other ways of funding these, and I think there probably are other ways of funding them rather than using the tax dollars.
And that was one of the things I wanted to ask you, Professor Castevant. One of the things that when we did our show or our program 2 weeks ago was that Representative Kaufman talked about this and said, look, we're not saying that you can't have a sabbatical. We're saying over the next 18 months, it's not going to come from taxpayer dollars, that if you want to use other dollars available to the university through boosters or what, I'm not going to use the right terminology there. But is there another way to fund these than other than the money you get from taxpayers?
I think in some areas there certainly might be. I think it concerns me, though, that that would then somehow make it sound like, you know, departments and programs that have resources for one reason or another are more worthy of faculty, having this opportunity to develop. I think that it would be preferable if it were across the university and the those decisions, the internal resource allocation that would have to be done could be done at the university level, and that it wouldn't, preferentially benefit one department or one, you know. I think of it in terms of students. I think the students in a particular department shouldn't suffer because their department, you know, didn't have either, you know, philanthropic support or external grant support or some other source of revenue that could support the sabbaticals for them. I think, you know, it's an institutional program, and I think it should remain at that level.
All right. Let's take a quick call before we change topics this morning. Let's talk to Craig from Cedar Rapids. Craig, thanks so much for calling the Exchange.
Well, some people say that there's an arrogance in higher education where they just don't care because they don't think it's their money. And you can kind of see that because they get students so far in debt and they don't seem to care about the ramifications of that. And I could give many other examples. Is that enough?
Let me let the professor respond to that. Thanks for the call, Craig.
So, I mean, I can only speak to my own situation. I'm very concerned about what it costs students. I have three kids of my own. The youngest one is a junior in college now. Thankfully, I've only got three more semesters to pay for. But as one example, a counterexample to that, my freshman course that I'm teaching this spring, the publisher of the textbook came out with a seventh edition of the book. I looked very closely at the books and saw that there wasn't enough of a difference. We used the sixth edition so that the students could buy used copies. I mean, I'm sure that there is that perception of that arrogance that the caller talks about is real in some cases, but in my colleagues, I don't really see that.
Well, and you don't, you know, most of the professors don't set tuition or set state funding levels, which and sometimes are directly related to tuition. But let me ask you, Representative Wagner, that does bring up a larger question. We only have a few moments left, but also in this legislation, there is a reduction in state spending for the universities. The sabbaticals is just a tiny component. We talked about it because it's interesting and people kind of hook on that and want to hear about it. But there's a reduction in funding for the public universities of $40 million over the next 3 years, I believe. Isn't that a larger issue, really?
Sure. And the reason that came about is as we went through and drafted this bill in discussions with the universities, that's what they asked for rather than having line item cuts. We originally had, and if you go look at, there's other cuts in office supplies, marketing, you name it, those types of deals. The university came back and said, we don't budget that way. We don't have those line items. Can you just give us, an equal, whatever our amount equals in those cuts, and we'll deal with those cuts the way we want. One of the other things that we did put in there is restricting the tuition increases to the national
higher index,
right?
Higher education.
And I think that's important because what we've seen in the past when the universities have seen cuts is they've just immediately went to the students and said, you're going to pay higher tuition. And in one case, I believe it was the University of Iowa this last time, they just instituted a $100 fee across board for every student. That's not the right way to do that either. And we want to make sure that they're being right to our students.
All right. Representative Wagner, Professor Cassavant, thank you so much for your time today. When we come back on The Exchange, we're going to talk about item on the chopping block, funding for passenger rail. You're listening to The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. Good afternoon. You're listening to The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Janine Beck, and we're live from the Law Library of the State Capitol Building in Des Moines. Last year, Iowa received a $230 million grant from the U.S. Department of Transportation to begin passenger rail service from Chicago to Iowa City via the Quad Cities. The new Green Line, with service to commence in 2015, was to provide two daily round trips and carry trains traveling at speeds of 70 to 9 miles an hour to make that five-hour drive or a five-hour trip for 219 miles. But last week, the Iowa House approved the so-called Taxpayers First Act on a party-line vote of 60 to 40. It reduces funding for passenger rail by $2.7 million this year and eliminates funding the $20 million necessary to match the federal funds over the next 4 years. Joining me to discuss that decision, Representative Jason Schultz of Schleswig, that's right, of Western Iowa, a Republican, and Nancy Quellhorst is the President and CEO of the Iowa City Area Chamber of Commerce. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
My pleasure.
And Nancy, you're at our studios in Iowa City. Thanks so much. Well, let's ask about this bill, first of all, and the decision to reduce the matching fund, which would mean largely we'd have to give up that grant. What was the thought process behind that, Representative?
The thought process behind the entire bill, I'll speak in grander terms and then move to this, was that Iowa faces a $700 million gap. The reason for that gap is because every program looked like a good program. Every program that's come before the legislature for the past few years has made the claim, possibly true, possibly not, that it will return more dollars than we invest into it. And due to a lack of priority and a willingness to fund each and every program, we are now most of $1 billion in the red. That was the big picture. The smaller picture, as we went through, we were looking at individual cuts, individual programs that could come to this very first bill, House File 45, and we looked at programs that that we were not sure. We didn't buy the sale. The idea that it would return this many dollars for this many I wasn't convinced myself, and we just didn't believe it was a good time for taxpayers to be funding a specialized project such as this.
Mm-hmm. It is a lot of money, $20 million mm-hmm. over the next 4 years mm-hmm. in state funding to match that $230 million grant. There have been figures bandied about that it was a $25 million increase in business activity, but that's through the entire corridor, and that Iowa would see 6 to 7 million of mm-hmm. that. Yet even an Iowa State economist, David Swenson, suggested that he wasn't even sure the economic activity would be as much as $6 or $7 million. Is that the concern?
That was one of my personal concerns. I look at it through the lens of history. Whenever access to a metropolitan area is made easier, less expensive, economic activity moves to that urban area. Ever since the Industrial Revolution, metro areas have gained commercial activity. People have moved to them. I don't know of an example where making it easier to do business away from the city has drawn the business out. It always draws it to the metro.
Well, so then is this a parochial issue? Is this I'm not from Iowa City and we're not going to gain the benefit in Schleswig, so I don't want it?
I don't see it that way. I see it as more an issue. If I really believed it would work just exactly as they said, I could look at it then as we would be increasing state revenues. That would ease our job. It would allow us to provide better the services that the core purposes of government. I would be looking at education, transportation, public safety. We would better be able to meet those obligations if we were looking at increased revenue. I just don't believe that's going to happen.
Nancy Quellhorst, let me bring you into this discussion. Concerned about the depletion of these funds, do you think Iowa will lose this grant?
I don't, and I have to tell you, Representative Schleswig, I sincerely appreciate your fiscal responsibility with our budget. I think that's very important. Fortunately, we do have a model out there that shows us that this route could be very successful, and that is the route that's very similar that goes to Quincy, Illinois. Travels on the same ownership, serves a population center that is smaller than is ours, and has been so very successful that in the last 5 years, the ridership has increased 15% or more every year. I would also suggest that social patterns are changing, and where some of the historical data that you referenced with regard to economic activity and how it moves from the smaller area to the larger metro areas is really changing. If you look at the social patterns of young people as they exist today, they want to have access to large metro areas, but they don't necessarily want to live there. And I think access is the key word to them. They don't necessarily need to own transportation like an automobile, but they want to be able to access a large city. And I can tell you that the retailers in downtown Iowa City believe that much of their success is predicated on visitorship from people in large metro areas.
All right. We want to also open our conversation today to our listeners. Have you ridden Amtrak before? Was it a positive experience? Would you ride it if it came to Iowa? If not, tell us why. And also, do you think this is a good use of taxpayer dollars? We'd like you to join our conversation at 1-866-780-9100. Number to call is 1-866-780-9100. You can find us on Twitter at IPR Talk, and you can email us at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We did receive a tweet earlier from Nolan, who says passenger rail is part of the future of the greener transportation in this state, and that cutting the funding for this partnership would be foolish. What about the green issue, Representative Schultz? Do you worry that that this is the future in the sense of trying to provide a more environmentally friendly mode of transportation?
That part itself doesn't bother me. The never hurts to be cleaner. It never. However, it sure seems to be my experience that every time the word green or environmentally sensitive is brought up, it ends up adding cost to the project, and it misallocates dollars from what the free market is seeking to reward to what an agenda would like to see put in place. I think that's I consider the green movement a tool of inefficiency.
All right. Let's talk to Sam in West Branch. Thanks so much for calling the Exchange, Sam.
Yeah. Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, in terms of rail for the future, we need to make it successful. You know, when you look at our competitors in China, they've built thousands of miles of high-speed rail, and they just opened one that set a world speed record. We need that kind of transportation. We need to move to the future. And in terms of putting people to work, we need to put people to work not selling candles made in low standard of living countries or filling box stores with junk that's going to the landfill. We need to put people work building the infrastructure for our future. And we've already dumped a huge debt on our young people, and we need to ensure that we build the kind of world that they're going to find even better than the one we have today. And that's my comment.
Sam, thanks for the call. But one of the things that Sam brought up, Nancy, is he talked about high-speed rail. Now, the top speed for this train is going to be what, 79 miles an hour?
Yes.
Average speed somewhere in the 50s, is that right?
Yes, 79 mile an hour.
People about that on the interstate these days.
However, when you drive, you have to pay attention to what you're doing, and the next generation wants to be texting and enjoying each other's company and not being concerned about the stress that is the result of having to deal with traffic and the expense that is the result of having to park in a big city like Chicago.
Is this a generational issue, Nancy, that people that grew up with cars, I mean, we've all long joked that in Iowa, people are, you know, married to their automobiles. They will drive an hour to work and an hour from just to live where they want, but they like that convenience. But is that changing in your opinion?
I believe it is. I think although certainly the elderly will take advantage, the people who have young children and want to be able to give children their attention along the trip are going to take interest, as will the people who may have infirmities that prevent them from driving. I do think it is very progressive, and I think it's critical that we position Iowa as a progressive state right now. As you know, our population is not growing to the extent that as are those in other states, and so it's critical that we look at defining ourselves as a progressive state. This is one of the ways we can do that.
Representative Schultz, do you have concerns, though, about the speed, that it's not high speed, that it's, I mean...
The fact that it is not a high speed rail takes away from the project. Yes, it does. If I believe it will attract less ridership if it is simply traveling as fast or not as fast as a car would travel the same route.
Yeah, I mean, I think it said Iowa City to Chicago about 5 hours. that's pretty similar drive mm-hmm. time.
That same from those that I know that have made the trip. Yes, mm-hmm.
I'd like to add, if I may, that if you look at some states who started with service that had a maximum speed of 79 miles per hour, they have invested to increase the rate of speed on which the train travels now. So this is an early stage for us. I think if you look at the interstate highway system, for example, it was an arduous battle. It did not have its current form when it was initially initiated. And so if you look now at putting the infrastructure in place, we will have ample opportunity to increase the speed at which trains will travel. And again, I point to the Quincy route as a wonderful example that people will ride the train. I've been the beneficiary of that service, having lived there for 7 years, and I watched how frequently people went to Chicago for a day from that area.
I want to talk about an email we received from Dave in Cedar Falls, because Dave has a question that I was actually about to ask as well. Dave, thanks for this. Representative Schultz, what would your position be regarding passenger rail if you felt the funds were available? I mean, is this something that if the state were flush with cash, you would be more supportive of?
To be quite honest, I'm not a huge believer in rail in this country, in this state. I've been to Germany, I've been to Europe, and I've ridden the passenger rail there, where you have a town, a station every five, 7, 10 miles. We don't have that situation here. And we
is
are
the
married
size
to
it. Of our country? Is that part of it?
I just think we're so vast. Our population density is so low compared to places where this does work. If it did work, I'm not against it philosophically. I'm against it. Well, I misspoke. I am not against it. I don't want to lend my support to something that I don't believe is inherently going to be a success.
May I add something about that?
Oh, sure.
One thing I think it's important that you know is if you speak with officials from Amtrak, your initial reaction folks have is much like yours, and that is that population density is the basis for a functioning train route. And what we have learned through our work with Amtrak is that efficient rail travel and successful routes are predicated on two things. One of those is choice, so travelers want to have more than one option, which this route will have. And the other is...
Did I lose
Nancy?
Her again?
I think we lost... Lost Nancy?
I'm sorry.
Good.
Excuse me. One of those is choice, and the other is an on-time performance record. And the route that I've talked about that goes to Quincy, which would be very similar, has had 95.5% on-time performance over the January through November period of last year. And we have every reason to believe that ours would be exactly the same. And so those are the two characteristics that need to be in place. And Quincy and Macomb are population centers far less than those of Iowa City and Quad Cities.
Well, go ahead. Let me.
Well,
let you respond.
I guess I'd like to include in here somewhere the and I certainly don't mean to make this. This isn't intended to be an arguable point or an argument, but part of the reason I believe that we saw House File 45 was the desire over the last 4 years to make Iowa a more progressive state. Programs are expensive. And as a neighbor of mine this weekend, I was visiting, bringing him up to date on what the legislature was doing. He brought up the point that there's no such thing as a bad program to those who want it. The trouble is that when you fund each and every one of them, you eventually find yourself with a $700 million spending gap, and then something has to go. And then it comes down to the priorities of those that the taxpayer sent to the legislature. Do we use your money for this? Do we use your money for this? In this case, we had a public hearing. It was, I believe, we only had two or three people out of 90 that brought up the issue of rail.
One of them was, though, that I remember hearing was a Marshalltown economic development official or, mm-hmm. or a chamber official, mm-hmm. Sort of what Nancy does, but in Marshalltown. Mm-hmm. And I remember being somewhat surprised by that, thinking, well, that's out of the area in which the service would be provided. And mm-hmm. I was, do you remember that one?
I do.
Were you surprised?
And I remember thinking, and certainly this, I don't mean this in a negative connotation, but I believe that was a message from the mindset that government is economic development. I'm from the completely opposite end of the table. I believe that you release the free market and it will develop itself, that government only stands in the way. And when the government allocates people's labor, which is measured in tax dollars, it typically misallocates dollars and it skews, it makes the, it makes the, uh, the it makes the table not level. Mm-hmm. And certain places win, certain places lose. I'd prefer the government stays out of this. As we talk about the taxpayer, the DOT, if you divide out the DOT's numbers as to expense, projected jobs, we're looking at $125,000 per projected job. We're also looking at $3 million a year in maintenance. I don't think the Iowa taxpayers voted this year to see those numbers be maintained.
All right. Let's look at let's talk to some of our listeners. We've got a tweet from Iowa City, from the band The Nadas. We did our tour out west by rail. It was an amazing experience. We will be going by rail when possible, and we'd love to see it expand. We also want to talk to Anne from Iowa City. Anne is a student. Thanks for calling The Exchange.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I'm a medical student here in Iowa City, and I actually went to college out on the East Coast where I very frequently used rail and buses. And coming back to Iowa City, I was raised here, it definitely has been interesting for me to not have the non-driving options when hoping to go to a larger metropolitan area, whether it's for job interviews, for socializing, or even to access greater airport options in the Chicago area. I definitely know that I would use, and I believe my cohorts that are in my age group would be interested in having a non-driving option, such as rail, to get into Chicago.
All right. Thanks for the call, Ann. Governor Terry Branstad held his weekly news conference this morning and spoke with reporters about this issue and said he still hasn't decided whether to include funding for passenger rail in his budget, which he is going to submit to the legislature this coming Thursday. What do you expect as the session moves on? Have you talked to Democrats in the Senate? Because as I talked about in the first half of the program, that's where this bill goes next. Mm-hmm. What are you hearing?
I believe related to passenger rail, I believe once again, getting back to the word priorities, when we're having arguments over whether we can have a preschool program, whether we can, the values fund is being cut, my feel is that the passenger rail is not a priority of legislators in the House or the Senate. I think there's other priorities that they're more offended by being cut, and they live under the same law of physics or law of monetary rule that we have a $700 million gap.
Nancy, let me ask about this. $20 million is a lot of money, but so is $230 million. Do you think, and there are other states looking at this as well, there are other newly elected Republican governors who are suggesting in other states that they also return the funding, that they think this is not cost effective. Do you think some other state will, you know, benefit because Iowa turns it down possibly?
I don't see that as our future. I think we have great support from both Senator Dvorsky and Senator Gronstahl. The good news is that we have plenty of time. The construction that is required for this will not take place until 2013 and 2014. Initially, there will be more limited funding required for the environmental and planning work, so we have some time for that to come to fruition. Also, I think they'll look at the data and see that, according to the Iowa Department of Transportation data, we will have $2.77 result from every dollar that we invest in this. And so, and this is from the standardized values issued from our Department of Transportation. And so we fully anticipate that although it may not be an easy road, they will certainly recognize the benefit and be supportive.
So you think there's time left to fight this fight?
Yes.
Well, let me ask you, do you suspect that if this is not built, I know that we had a freeway expansion in the Des Moines area over the last many years, largely complete now, but since it's been completed, there's already talk that there's congestion, that it didn't do the trick. I mean, Nancy, do you think that that's going to be an issue, that the funding will come and be necessary in another way if not rail, if that makes sense? I mean, will there need to be an expansion of freeways, highways, if the country doesn't look at rail?
No, on the contrary, I don't think this will be to the detriment of highway improvement at all. In fact, I would suggest that this may reduce some of the wear and tear on highway. The roads would likely deteriorate at a slower rate.
Well, I guess that's what I'm asking. You know, is it just a shift in funding? If we don't do rail, do you think there'll need to be more work done, is I guess what I'm asking, on freeways and highways because of the increased...
Yes, absolutely. And I also think that the cost of highway accidents enters into this as well.
Is there a safety issue there? I haven't brought that up, Representative Schultz. Is rail safer?
I don't know. I'll be honest. I'm not going to make a comment on something I haven't researched. That's a point that could be brought up by both sides. Mm-hmm. I would welcome that information. I'm not going to try to comment
sure.
on something.
Oh, yeah, I understand.
I hadn't thought to bring that into the.
What about the wear and tear issue and the, you know, will we pay for it in a different way?
For myself?
Yeah.
Well, that actually is one of the issues that I'm concerned about. Is a lot of the money that comes is right now. Still allocated to go to public rail will come out of our road funds. It also comes, and this part I actually will claim representation of Western Iowa. It will also come away or take dollars away from public transit, which in Western Iowa for the elderly is a big deal. Excuse me. I would oppose any of those dollars going away from concrete and rebar in the roads and going away from public transit in Western Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Nancy Quellhorst, let me ask you about safety. Is that something that's come up as this has unfolded?
It has. I don't have the data in front of me, but the safety issue has come to the forefront, as has the ability to travel to the city without incurring any kind of inclement weather challenges. So certainly more reliable than would be air travel and safer, particularly during this time of year, than automobile travel.
All right. Nancy Quellhorst is the president and CEO of the Iowa City Chamber of Commerce. Republican Representative Jason Schultz of Schleswig is from Western Iowa. Thank you both for being on the program today.
Thank
we appreciate
you.
It.
My
House File 45 now goes to the Iowa Senate, where its future is uncertain at this point, a Democratic-controlled Senate. You've been listening to The Exchange, produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Dennis Reese, Brian Dow, and John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Remember, podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available at iowapublicradio.org. And we welcome your comments and your questions about this program anytime at TheExchange@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Janine Beck. Thanks for joining us. Boxing.